Our next guest is Jules Evans. Jules is a best-selling author whose work focuses on ecstatic experiences, and he's the director of the Challenging Psychedelic Experiences Project, which conducts research into the potential harms that can come about from psychedelic use and how to prevent them. So, Jules, welcome and thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Ali. Thanks for having me.
So, Jules, I thought a good place to start would be to ask you a bit about what it is about the challenging side of psychedelics, what it is about challenging psychedelic experience, adverse effects, that you felt called to research. You know, why research that?
Sure. I've been interested in ecstatic experiences since I was a teenager, and I've written about them. One of my books was called The Art of Losing Control, which was in essence arguing that we should be more open to ecstatic experiences in Western culture. However, I'm also interested in, you know, the darker side of ecstatic experiences, how these kind of, by ecstatic experiences, that's also like mystical, psychedelic, altered states, trance states. So there is a dark side to these experiences as well. They, you know, people can leave their ordinary identity and ordinary sense of reality and not really come back, or at least land in a different place where they feel worse. So there are mental health risks. People can become fanatical. They can end up in toxic kind of groups. So, I mean, not all ecstatic experiences are good for you or good for your society. So I've always been interested in that. Another book that I co-edited was about spiritual emergencies, which is a word for basically ecstatic or spiritual type experiences, which are also psychologically messy and disturbing and can lead to kind of ego disruption for weeks or months or sometimes years. I'm curious about, you know, how people navigate those kinds of difficult ecstatic experiences. I suppose I should mention just briefly that, you know, there's a personal interest to this. I've always been drawn to seeking ecstatic experiences like lots of people. And so I've also had personal experiences of the good and the bad. When I was a teenager, that was my most intense phase of psychedelic experimentation. I had lots of wonderful psychedelic experiences, but I also had, you know, one or two really bad ones. And one in particular, when I was 18, led to me developing kind of anxiety problems, which lasted for a few years. And really coping with that and learning how to recover is what really cemented my interest in mental health, in philosophy, in psychology, and spirituality. So I started the project that I work on, the Challenging Psychedelic Experiences Project, in 2021, which was the height of hype and optimism around psychedelics. As you remember, Ali, billions of dollars were suddenly going into psychedelic companies. For people like you who'd been in the field for many years, and to some extent me, it was extraordinary, because something that had been so kind of niche and kind of taboo was suddenly like front page of the Wall Street Journal, listing on the NASDAQ, and you know, incredibly positive media coverage after decades of anti-drug propaganda. And I was fascinated by that and fascinated by the new research. But I also thought, where is the research and where's the public conversation on the risks and on the harms? These aren't risk-free substances. So that was why I saw the need for more research on harms and what helps people deal with those harms. And I thought, okay, well, let's do it ourselves. So I got together with a group of particularly psychologists and psychotherapists, mainly based in the UK at different universities like Imperial, UCL, Greenwich University. And we wanted to research what kind of difficulties people get into after taking psychedelics. How long do they last? What kind? What helps them deal with these difficulties? So that's really the aim of our project. And we've produced, we've got three papers and more in the pipeline.
Yeah, I want to touch on, in a moment, I want to touch on what the specifics are, but I think it's just important to underscore, you know, you've pointed to this already. A lot of us who've been in the space for some time and had our own personal experiences have either had an adverse experience or have seen someone have one. You know, I've seen I had my own in my 20s, which led to, what I probably classify as PTSD now, looking back, very formative experience, but not one I would really wish on anyone, and not what I necessarily think is necessary to have as well. And so I think that, a lot of us were looking at, yeah, like you're saying, this boom in the, let's say 2021, but it is already happening with the positive news coverage that had started coming out before then, seeming to leave out the dangerous side of it. So, I mean, do you think, to what degree do you think that leaving out is intentional by labs or media, or do you think it was just a, let's not rock the boat, let's talk about the positives, or do you think, what do you think is going on there?
Various different things. First of all, I do think that there has been a conscious and to some extent unconscious effort on the side of research to minimize adverse experiences. And we've seen that in a number of the big trials and a number of the big research centers. And there are various reasons for that. The main one is the people funding psychedelic research on the whole, and the people doing psychedelic research on the whole are true believers. They are deeply committed. They take psychedelics themselves. It's part of their spiritual practice a lot of the time, and they're deeply committed to the idea that psychedelics can save the world. So, I mean that's the vision of Rick Doblin. That was the vision of Roland Griffiths. Even Michael Pollan ends his Netflix documentary saying psychedelics can maybe save humanity. So they're very emotionally invested in it, spiritually invested in it, and to some extent financially invested in it as well. This is their careers. So for that reason, I think that inclines people to try and minimize adverse experiences when they appear on trials. The other reason is, talk about the financial side of things. You had we were doing psychedelics when we were teenagers and we had our bad experiences as teenagers. What's happened in the last few years is a lot of people have come to psychedelics for the first time in their 30s, particularly people in venture capitalism. And they've had a few wonderful experiences and they've gone, wow, this is incredible. This is going to change the world. This is going to save the world. I'm all in. Let's roll this out at scale. And so there's a kind of newbie naivety there. And there's also a financial incentive. This is for some of them a big business play. So, it's a classic pharma behavior, big pharma behavior in a way. You have a new product. You don't want to make a lot of noise about the nasty side effects. You want to sell your product. So I think those are, and then probably the third reason is this historical trauma in the psychedelic community about what happened in the 60s and 70s. There was 15 years of fantastic research. It was very exciting. And then suddenly, well, not suddenly, but over kind of 5 years, it got shut down for various reasons. Everyone's got their own different historical narrative about why that shutdown happened, but it did. Research dried up. Psychedelics were put on Schedule One. They were prohibited even, for research. And that, everyone in the field is terrified that it's going to happen again, that this is all going to be shut down. And so for a long time, I think the feeling was, don't give anti-drug prohibitionists stones to throw at us. So don't talk too much about the negative and the adverse. I think that's shifting now. What you see with kind of the leaders in the field is a sense that before they thought it was risky to talk about adverse experiences. And now I think there's a sense it's risky not to talk about it because the number of people taking psychedelics is rising so quickly in most Western countries that, lots of people are trying psychedelics for the first time. When some of them have difficult experiences and extended difficulties, they might well turn around and say, why didn't anyone tell me about this? So I think those are the principal reasons.
Yeah, no, thank you for that. I think that's a nice broad, and I think it really ties into to what I've observed as well. It's a complex swirl of different values and hopes and dreams. So let's talk a little bit about what exactly the adverse experiences are that people might have on psychedelics. What are some of the most common?
Okay, well, there's two things. First of all, there's adverse experiences that people can experience while under the effects of psychedelics, as in the kind of 4 to 8 to 12 hours when they might be under the influence of a psychedelic. I mean, first of all, they're the expected kind of effects. Like you might feel weird physical symptoms, shivering, shaking, nausea, headaches, and so on, and you might very well hallucinate. This is kind of normal, expected, and for a lot of people, that's the whole point. But for some people, if they're not used to psychedelics, that could be frightening. Your ego is going to undergo alterations. It can be described as a form of kind of lucid dreaming. You're less rational, you're less critical. All of that, you're much more suggestible. This is why it can be healing, but it can also why it can be harmful. You're also much more sensitive to cues, to influences in your environment, whether that's whatever's in your head at the time or whatever's in your context. So it makes you vulnerable to undue influence by your facilitator, guide, or whoever you're taking psychedelics with. Now, some people, in fact, about 50% of people who take psychedelics have had one or more challenging experience. A positive psychedelic experience can be the most wonderful, blissful experience of your life. A challenging experience can be one of the most frightening experiences of your life. It can involve things like panic, social anxiety, paranoia, fear of going mad, feeling like you're in hell. When the word psychedelic was coined by the British psychiatrist Humphrey Osmond, he came up with a rhyme. He said, "To fathom hell or to soar angelic, just take a pinch of psychedelic." A lot of the coverage of psychedelics has been about soar angelic, but sometimes people fathom hell. And that's obviously not a very pleasant experience, particularly because psychedelics distort time. So you can feel like you're in hell for days, weeks, or months. Now, a lot of people, even if they have these kinds of challenging experiences, still feel they grow from them in some way. Maybe it brings to light, their deepest fears and helps them confront it and process it. But sometimes it's overwhelming. They just think, "Oh my God, I can't handle this." And it actually can be traumatizing for that reason. So about in one survey, the Canadian Psychedelic Survey, if people want to look it up, 40% of people who had a challenging experience felt that no good came from it. And something like 7% ended up seeking kind of psychological support afterwards. So that's the kind of challenging experience. And sometimes that leads to difficulties which last after the experience. In another paper by Simonson and all last year, 9% of people who took psychedelics said it sometimes led to functional impairment lasting longer than a day after the experience. In a Norwegian psychedelic survey, 23% of people said that it led to functional difficulties lasting longer than a day. So what kind of difficulties? These might be minor, like difficulty concentrating or some mild derealization, feeling a bit disconnected from your social environment and so on, feeling a bit more emotionally sensitive. But sometimes these extended difficulties can last for longer. They can last for days, weeks, months, or sometimes years and decades. So we did a research study asking people who'd experienced these kinds of extended difficulties, how long did it last, and what did you experience? In our survey, a fifth of people who'd had extended difficulties told us they lasted longer than a year. And a sixth said they'd lasted longer than 3 years. So sometimes they last a long time. The most common types of difficulties that people experienced after psychedelics were firstly increased anxiety. And there's all kinds of types of fear and anxiety within that, like fear you've damaged yourself, fear you go mad, fear of the experience repeating, fear of other people, and so on. A second type of common extended difficulty was existential confusion. What the hell was that experience? How do I make sense of it? How do I fit it into my worldview? A third was derealization and depersonalization, feeling detached from your ordinary sense of reality and your ordinary sense of self. Some people might enjoy that, but a lot of people get disturbed by it. It destabilizes their sense of reality. And then two last types of common difficulty that came up in our study. One was feeling socially disconnected from the people around you. Let's think about it. You take psychedelics, you go back to your culture. They're not common in your culture. You go back to your office on Monday after going to a psychedelic retreat. You're feeling weird. You're still feeling slightly in another state, in another place. And suddenly you're back at your job in an accountancy firm. They're not familiar with ecstatic states and unusual mystical experiences. So people can sometimes think, who do I talk to about this? We are not a very psychedelically literate or ecstatically literate culture yet. Anyway, and then there are just other kinds of unusual phenomena that can arise, like persistent visual distortions, insomnia, and others. And what happens, Ali, is that we get emails from people sometimes, my project, saying, I went to an ayahuasca retreat, or I self-medicated with psilocybin, or I smoked DMT, and I don't feel I've been the same since. And my symptoms are A, B, C, D, and I'm terrified. Who do I turn to for help for this? So, there are people who look to psychedelics for healing and end up developing new symptoms. And suddenly they're like, who do I go to for help from this? Do I need to go to a psychiatrist? Do I need to go to a shaman? Do I need an exorcism? What do I do? And so it's very frightening for people. And one of the big messages I want to get across to people in the field is we need a better safety net, because psychedelics help an awful lot of people and they have positive experiences. But there is this percentage, and it could be maybe 10%, who have difficult experiences that lead to difficulties that continue. And we need better research and better support for those people. And I think that the psychedelic culture and industry has kind of got quite far ahead without that safety net being in place.
Yeah, I think it's a very important message. And it strikes me, if I look at my own experience with which included visual what it's called HPPD, but it was very distinct to me, which was facial apophenia, which is where you recognize faces, where you recognize people who, like, I remember vividly being in Paddington Station one time and thinking, it's very anxiety related, as you say, it was a very anxiety response. I'm thinking, like, oh, that's the guy I went to high school with, and having to be like, probably not, mate. It's
Oh,
probably not.
really?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, but if I look at my experience, in some ways, I wish I had. I was in my mid-20s, so I wasn't used to going to therapy or even seeking that out. It was formative in that way. It is something that brought me there. But to speak to your point, like, there wasn't one thing in particular that helped. What it was a combination of things that eventually and ending in some sense with a breathwork session, which help me go back to the root of the traumatic experience, relive it, reprocess it, and that was sort of the beginning of the end of that era. And so what it makes me curious about is the role of traumatic experiences, because I know David Erritzoe, who heads up the Imperial College Center for Psychedelic Research, he told me one time that he reckons HPPD, so that kind of persistent visual distortion, is much more common when people have had a traumatic experience, acute experience. So they've had effectively a difficult trip that they weren't able to sort of process at the time. Are you seeing anything similar to that? When people come to you, are they kind of saying, look, I had a really bad trip and now I have all this stuff happening? Or how does it usually kind of pan out?
Yes. I can say that in our data set, more people have difficult experiences, and it leads to them feeling kind of overwhelmed, stuck in the experience, really frightened, And then they develop difficulties afterwards. That's not entirely the case. So some people have very positive experiences, but then struggle to integrate it into their life in some way, to like make sense of it. I think you might well be right about HPPD, these kinds of visual distortions being more common in traumatic type experiences. But you know, we don't know yet. There's very little research published on any of these kinds of things. Like you mentioned that apophenia, like it affected how you recognize faces. I mean, in our survey, others said they had difficulty recognizing faces of familiar people. So it kind of affects the brain in all kinds of interesting ways. I mean, some people get so much derealization, they think for a while they're either in a dream or that they've died and they're in the afterlife. So that's like, I mean, there are these unusual syndromes. I interviewed someone who took part in a psilocybin trial, had never taken psilocybin before, and they developed permanent genital arousal disorder for years. And you know, not as fun as it sounds.
What is that exactly? I mean, that's just
It's
permanently.
like it's like a it's a it's very it's rare, but it's a nervous system activation. So if you think about things like Kundalini awakening or like the kind of shaking or so ecstatic experiences through meditation, psychedelics, and so on can like alter your nervous system in unpredictable ways and your energy system. And in this case, you know, she has variety of kind of, you know, she's light sensitivity. She's kind of very sensitive to touch. She can't sit still, and it affected, you know, her genitals as well. Like I you know, just this kind of a arousal, but in a way that makes her life impossible. And she actually, you know, anyway, so I mean, this lady has applied to the assisted dying program in Canada since this trial. So,
Awful. Yeah.
yeah, so again, another, so there's two points I want to get across. One, we need more research on what kind of difficulties arise, and there's some obscure ones, and what helps people. Exactly like, you know, you were saying, Ali, what helped you? And we're trying to do research on that. We've got a paper coming out where we ask people who had extended difficulties, what did you find helpful? And just like you were saying, people said a whole bunch of different things. So it's a little difficult to get the signal in the noise because people said, oh, you know what helped me? It was acupuncture, it was slow breathing, it was reading Stan Grof, it was, you know, wild swimming. You know, and so you're like, okay, well, what helped for what particular thing? And this is the difficulty with the evidence for therapy in general, is like picking up what exactly helped. So that's hard. But then the other thing, just an obvious point, is that sometimes people feel worse after psychedelics, including under clinical trial conditions, because that you know, so, leading figures in psychedelics have said no one has ever come out of a clinical trial feeling worse. And that's not the case. Sometimes people have come out feeling worse, maybe more suicidal if you know, if they have serious depression, more anxious, and so on.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I know of some examples myself. So, the other thing that strikes me as important is preparation, right? Because a lot of this comes after the fact. If someone's had the experience and then afterwards. I think there's been a lot of focus in the psychedelic world around the importance of integration. So what you do after the experience to make sense of it and bring it into your life, which is very, very important.
Yeah.
But I'm kind of increasingly of the belief that preparation might be more important, or as important, certainly as important, if not more important. But I think about my, if I think about my experiences on the Imperial College DMT trial, which was, very intense, probably the most experientially intense clinical trial out there. There were lots of synchronicities and lots of sort of existential weirdness happening afterwards. And had I not had meditation training, known about the increase in synchronicity that people might experience and not read too much into it, but just observe it as a phenomena, stay centered, stay sort of internally scientific about it, I think I would have struggled more. I would have, it, well, I didn't struggle really so much, but I think I would have struggled because some of it was so outlandish, strange, hard to integrate into life. And for me, that really came through preparation. And so I always encourage people to prepare well. But I've noticed that, some trials do it well and some trials don't do it at all, really, or they do it very, very in a limited way. I'm curious if you've thought about preparation recently.
I have, and I've thought about, and I think, in one person I interviewed who took part in a trial, when she went for her session, she was very dysregulated and she was in tears and so on. She was not in a good headspace, but she felt, well, this is my one shot. And so I'm curious about when these things are rolled out and you come to your trip day, but what are you going to do? You're going to cancel and you might still have to pay, but you're not in the right headspace on that particular day. And then there's the issue of informed consent, where retreat centers, treatment centers, and so on, to what extent do they tell people about the risks of bad trips or extended difficulties? Because some people say, oh, but you could prime people for these difficulties then. Well, I think that's true, but that's kind of weird about these treatments where, by the way, don't be afraid of a bad trip because it might happen, kind of thing, but I also, Ali, I want to mention just, I remember I've heard you talking about your extended DMT experience. I'm like, good for you. Talk about deep sea diving, and weird sea creatures coming to you, and you just keep your cool and keep your core. So of course I can see why indigenous traditions think of these things as like initiations, because you're confronting freaky things and holding your ground, and that leads to a certain kind of firmness and so on. But I mean, I also think there's an interesting conversation about entities to be had with psychedelics. Is that when people take psychedelics, they sometimes encounter these kinds of entities, and what is the nature of them? And until we know, and we're not ever going to know, is that a reason to be careful of psychedelics? Like, I've just been researching internal family systems, IFS, which is the most popular type of therapy in psychedelic culture. And in IFS, they have this idea that you can, you have different parts to your psyche, and you can talk to these parts and heal your parts. And all parts are good. There are no bad parts. Except there is this coda, which is there are sometimes bad parts, but those are what's called unattached burdens. And they're basically entities. Those are spirits. And this is an idea accepted by the leaders in IFS. And to me, I'm like, if you think that's the case, and you think there are malevolent entities out there, and that psychedelics open you up to them, is that a reason to be quite wary of psychedelics? And so, is that a conversation we should be having, as a field? What do you
It's a
think?
really interesting question. Yeah, I mean, in a way, I think it's definitely a conversation we should be having, because if you look at a lot of shamanic traditions, I have yet to come across one that says, look, these are all just aspects of self and they're all parts of ourselves. I mean, to make it even more confusing, my experiences at least have led me to think that a lot of the time that might be the case, that we're encountering some aspect of our unconscious mind that's manifesting in a particular way, and we have an opportunity to integrate it and create a new relationship with it and bring it into the whole. So quite a, I take usually quite a Jungian approach to it. And then sometimes there's entities that do not feel like an aspect of self or remotely related to me. And I think a lot of shamanic traditions would say you really have to be wary, like we do when if you go into a big city and you walk around and you've never been there before, you don't just automatically assume everyone's got your back and everyone's wonderful and
That's
like,
a very good metaphor.
yeah. Some, you know what? A lot of them might, but you have to have your wits about you. And there's a whole different type of, let's say, psycho-spiritual training skill set required for that. Then you would find in a therapy room necessarily. It's a different thing. This is another confusion. It's like, it's not necessary. It might be therapeutic in its effect, but the actual experience isn't, hey, all these entities are here for my own personal psychological journey. You know, it's much more like, hey, I'm in a city I've never been to before, and what tremendous opportunity and also what tremendous danger it poses.
And in indigenous cultures, sometimes it's just the shaman who takes the psychedelics and goes to that city and not their clients. But in Western culture, we are all suddenly, country bumpkins who just suddenly landed in downtown New York City. And we're wandering around going, this is a beautiful place. This is a place of light and love. How many of those
Absolutely.
people are
It's,
going to
and
get
that's
marked?
and one of the main features of lots of types of psychedelic shamanism is that shamans make alliances with certain spirits in order to heal, but also to protect from other spirits, you know. So it's really a it's you know, I write about this in my book. It's not so different from the internet, where you have these sort of disembodied intelligences everywhere. You don't quite know who to trust, who's catfishing you, what's fake news, what's real. It's very, very similar, right? And so this level of very profound discernment we need when we go into those spaces, I think that's my one, you know, that's usually my one biggest piece of advice to people is to really cultivate a sense of mindfulness and discernment, where you don't jump to conclusions about things. And in fact, I would say philosophically, the only thing you can really say for sure in a psychedelic experience is, I am having an experience right now. Now, that's the grounding of it. I'm right now having a particular type of experience. That's all I can say for sure. And then it's actually a very nice stance, because then we can kind of bring a real curiosity to it and say, like, well, I mean, how fascinating is it that there's these science fiction entities everywhere, and what on earth
Absolutely.
does it mean?
Absolutely. In the same way that deep sea diving is absolutely fascinating. You've got to do a paddy course to go
Yes,
diving. And
absolutely.
with psychedelics, you can just order them from Instagram and WhatsApp, and then people take them on their own.
What I'm curious, just to close off with, you know, that reminds me of all people, Timothy Leary. He's not my favorite person, but he wrote a book called The Politics of Ecstasy, which has some interesting ideas in it. One of them being a drug license for people, right? Like you're saying. So you need to, if you're going to take psychedelics, you have to have some kind of training. It raises a lot of questions as to who gives you that training, etc. But just if you just took that as a sort of idea, what are you hoping to see? What would you like to see for safe psychedelic use as it gets rolled out? Let's assume legalization movements happen beyond the clinical setting, and we see things like, you know, what's happened in Colorado, where plant medicines are legal for personal use. You know, what are some of the frameworks, or just general watch outs you'd like to have for that to go as well as it could?
As far as I've got to is I build a better psychedelic safety net. I'm agnostic about what happens, about the types of different types of legislation that might occur, but whatever legislation might occur, or even if none occurs, I think I have the same kind of harm reduction strategy, which is like learn, communicate, support. Learn is like learn more about the kind of risks and harms that happen and what helps people cope with those harms or hopefully avoid them altogether. So that means particularly more research, more like academic research. Secondly, communicate. Better communicate the risks and harms and the techniques to avoid them or to minimize them if they've happened. So that would be, maybe like if you go and buy psychedelics, for the first time, you have to watch a video or you have to do a test, that takes you, so you know, or you, there's, there's a psychologist, one of the team that I work with at UCL has developed a preparedness scale. So you can take this scale and see how prepared are you, how familiar are you with what happens. But also public health communication. There's been no public health communication campaigns around psychedelics, not by any of the big, health bodies, or so nothing really. And there's just Netflix documentaries called Fantastic Fungi and How to Have a Good Trip, right? So better communication, but also how journalists communicate about this. If you're talking about the benefits, mention the risks. Likewise, if you're talking about the risks, mention the benefits. And then third, support. If people get into difficulties, where do they go to support for support? So more online support groups where people can go to for support with integration, but also for integration with difficult trips as well. Maybe online support groups for particular types of difficulties or for particular groups like veterans, for example, or people with PTSD. And maybe like specialist clinics where, like we get emailed by people saying, I'm really struggling. It's been weeks since I took mushrooms or ayahuasca. Where do I go to for help? I would love if I could refer them to specialist clinics, which have the range of options, psychiatric, therapeutic, peer support. So those are some of the ideas for kind of, a better safety net and also better training for psychedelic guides, for psychiatrists, and for people outside of psychedelic culture to support people if they get into difficulties. So that if you're suffering after a difficult trip, and you go to someone for help, they don't make one of two mistakes. First of all, they don't over-spiritualize it and say, this is all the medicine knows what you need, just lean into it, because that might not be helpful to hear. Or secondly, they don't over-pathologize it and say, sorry, mate, you've broken your brain. That's it. You've got a disorder for the rest of your life. Here's some medication. So it's finding the middle ground between those kinds of extremes, finding what's helpful for the particular person. So, I'm somewhat on the skeptical side of things, though I've got obviously see a lot of people who love psychedelics and have been helped by them a lot. But really, I'm agnostic. Whatever way societies choose to go forward, I think that kind of, learn about the risks, learn about the harms, learn about harm reduction, communicate it, and find better ways to support people. That would be the basics for a kind of safety net.
Yeah, brilliant. Yeah, and I think what's nice about that is that feels actionable. Like it feels like that could, with a concerted effort among, different people in the community, be a possibility. So, excellent, Jules. Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you, Ali. Yeah, pleasure as always.